Absalom got himself a chariot of horses and 50 men to run before him. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way of the gate. And when any man had a dispute to come before the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "From what city are you from?" He said, "Your servant is of such and such a tribe in Israel." And Absalom would say to him, "See, your claims are good and right, but there is no man designated by the king to hear you." Then Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were judge in the land. Then every man with a dispute or cause might come to me, and I would give him justice." And whenever a man came near to pay homage to him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. Thus Absalom did to all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. I'm not sure there's a better story of deception and manipulation than the story of Absalom. In fact, the story begins well before this. And David's sons were actually quite good at manipulation and deception. He's not the first. Amnon does the same. He is manipulative and he is deceptive in getting Tamar, Absalom's sister. And through a series of events, Absalom deceives his father and many others and has Amnon killed. This is back in chapter 13. And he's gone for a few years, but Absalom apparently is very persuasive. He is very good with words and very good with people. And after a little bit of time, David's heart yearned for Absalom. He wanted him back. And so Absalom shows back up after a little while, and he begins this charade out in front of the gate, deceiving people and twisting words and making them think that he is on their side, unlike his father, David. Now, David had made his own mistakes, and that may have gone into some of the reason why some of what Absalom was saying was believable. In fact, many of these problems were the result, I think, in many ways, of David's own sin. And the sword coming to his house as it was prophesied would happen, and now his own children being impacted by his deceit with Bathsheba and his murder of Uriah. They learned their behavior from their father. And now we see some of his sons taking the same type of behavior in their own lives. This morning, I want to talk about this idea of manipulation and deceit. We talked a few weeks ago about the idea of gossip and more along the lines of self-control and just not keeping things in that should be kept in. And I told you a few weeks ago we were going to get to this subject, dealing with maybe the other side of that, which is actually manipulation, deceiving people. And I want to review just a couple things to get us back to where we need to be to get there. But I want to start with this statement from James 1, and just recognizing the seriousness of all of this, whether it is just the carelessness that we talked about in the last sermon, or talking about the true deceit and manipulation we're going to talk about this morning, that this is what James has to say about it. If you don't bridle your tongue, you deceive your heart. If you develop this lack of care, if you develop this inability to bridle your statements, you deceive yourself. And then he ultimately says this person's religion is worthless. And so this morning we're going to talk about the idea of deceitfulness, the idea of manipulation, and actually that finds its way quite often into what we're talking about originally, which is gossip. It is really something that is about the self. It is about self-promotion. It is about tearing someone else down. It is about harm. And so we talked a little bit about that in the last sermon, in seeing where this all falls in terms of gossip. Gossip can be the carelessness, but it also can be the deceit. And we looked at some of these terms like flattery and lying and backbiting. Some of that you see here with Absalom, don't you? Kind of the backbiting and the flattery. As he's trying to persuade all Israel to come to his side against his father. Now we're going to see he's not quite as successful as he thinks he will be. But he's pretty good at what he does. And so we talked about what is gossip. So I want to run through a few things, really, that it's not before we move on to this. And that is important, I believe, because so often we're hampered by problems and difficulties because we feel like we can't talk about them or deal with them. But we saw last time, it's not just public warnings. Jesus warns the people about the scribes and Pharisees, and he does so openly. He says, they preach to you, but they don't practice. And he calls them out for it. This is just one occasion, but he does it numerous times. It's not sharing actual concerns that exist like Chloe's people do with Paul in 1 Corinthians 1:11. He talks about this report he's hearing, this is not wrong. He's hearing legitimate concerns that need to be discussed. And so then he uses that and he talks about it. It's not even embarrassing stories. The Gospels are filled with them. Embarrassing stories about the apostles and sometimes the lack of discretion they used and their lack of understanding and some things that are just pretty embarrassing. But here's a really big one in Galatians 2, and that is Paul pointing out Cephas's sin. But Peter, he acts in such a way that he even pulls away Barnabas. The influence, the impact is bigger than himself. He influences everyone around him because of his hypocrisy, and Paul calls him out then, and then he writes a letter about it so that everyone can see. And it's not calling out clear sin. And so that's not what gossip is. What gossip is talking behind someone's back, bringing bad news with a bad heart, bad motive, bringing about bad results. And so ultimately is the idea of self-promotion. It is doing something with enmity in your heart. It is trying to bring revenge on someone or manipulate people. That's ultimately what gossip is about. It's not all those things we talked about before. Those were intended for good. This is something that is intended for bad, a lot like Absalom here in the story. He's intending, we find out if we keep reading, he's intending to steal the kingdom from his father. He does not have good intentions. His intentions are not to tell Israel, hey, I wish you had a better judge. Let's work to get better judges in my father's kingdom. That's not his intention. That's not his goal. If he was pointing out simple error in David's kingdom and trying to help people correct it, that would be one thing. But what he's trying to do here is do something underhanded. He's trying to steal the kingdom from his father. And so I want to bring our attention to Proverbs chapter 6, because in Proverbs 6, it deals with some things that are pretty important to understand, and that are these seven abominations to the Lord. And I want us to see what these are. I want to begin back in verse 12, Proverbs chapter 6 and verse 12. It says, a worthless person, a wicked man, goes about with crooked speech. Now, it's not just verbal communication. I want us to understand this. That's why I went back to 12 and 13. Winks with his eyes, signals with his feet, points with his finger, with perverted heart devises evil, continually sowing discord. Therefore, calamity will come upon him suddenly. In a moment, he will be broken beyond healing. Now, remember that judgment statement there in Proverbs about the result of the one who does this sort of thing. But then he says this in verse 16, there are six things that the Lord hates, seven that are an abomination to him, haughty eyes, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that make haste to run to evil, a false witness who breathes out lies, and one who sows discord among brothers. Now it's always amazed me when I've looked at this passage that it talks about these abominations of the Lord. It's always amazed me that almost all of them involve the use of the tongue. It makes you think of James 3, that passage about this tongue being this fire. It's like that rudder on the boat, just this little thing, but it has so much power and so much influence, and it can set the whole forest ablaze. Just this small little part of the body, but it has so much power. And five of the seven things in here, at least, relate to the use of the tongue. And most of them have to do with manipulation and deceit, which is why God hates them. That's why they are an abomination. And I probably could make a case that shedding innocent blood and running to evil involve this kind of communication as well, but directly we know the other five are related to this. That is, the way we communicate, whether it's the winking of the eyes or the shuffling of the feet or the different things we do non-verbally to convey something, or actually the verbal statements that we make that sometimes are made to manipulate or to deceive, the Lord hates these. And what's so scary about this in reality is that it's easy to fall into these sins of the mouth. Maybe just a little embellishment of the facts, right? Just make the story a little bigger than what is actually true. Maybe we want this desire for exalting ourselves or promoting ourselves or for some personal benefit. And so we twist the story just a little bit to our own advantage. We keep most of it there in place, but just maybe a few statements or a few thoughts, we just change it a little. And that makes it really believable to people. People eat it up and they bring it in. And just like Absalom here in the story, they see the things he's saying and it sounds really good. And it sounds like something that could be true. Maybe just a little flattery to get my way. You know, I'll tell my boss some really good things. Just kind of pump him up a little bit and maybe I'll get that promotion from somebody else. Or maybe I just think this is the way it ought to be anyway. I mean, I'm right, so why don't I just kind of make this work the way I know it really should be, since I'm right anyway, and that ends justifies the means sort of thing. And it can become very easy for us to convince ourselves that these sorts of ideas are right. But we even believe it's true. I am convinced that Absalom really believed that he would be a better ruler than David. I mean, he's arrogant, so of course he believes that. But I'm convinced he actually believes it. He believes he's right. He's standing at the gate and he's trying to convince people, but he's self-deceived. He's unaware. He's undermining the authority of his father casually when people are vulnerable. He's taking these people who have these complaints, who have these concerns, and he's kind of sympathizing with them in a very fake and hypocritical sort of way. Oh, if I were judge, I would take care of all your problems. It's a lot more difficult than that, Absalom. And that's really easy to say, but likely not so easy to do. But now, remember what I said about nonverbal communication, right? He really goes beyond that. It's not just the statements, which are ludicrous in and of themselves. It's not just the statements, but when they come up and they're going to pay homage, he reaches out and grabs them and kisses them, right? He's kind of doing this PR work to make everyone like him. And of course, it works because people are so often foolish and they buy into what Absalom is selling. People often don't know the whole story. And especially when they're in a vulnerable state like these people are coming with complaints, and Absalom is saying, yes, I know your problems, and no one ever listens to you. I get it. I can take care of your problems if you would just let me handle it. Taking those people while they're vulnerable. And what's really corrupt about Absalom is he does all of this under the pretense of piety. You notice what he tells his father in the coming verses? You know, when I was away from Jerusalem, why were you away from Jerusalem, Absalom? Oh, yeah, you killed your brother. Okay. While I was away from Jerusalem, I made a vow. And so I'm going to go out and pay this vow. And so ironically, David says, okay, go in peace. Right? These are one of those ironies in the story as you're reading. You realize this is not at all for peace. In fact, the very next line, he's saying when the trumpet blows, then you're going to say Absalom is king at Hebron. So he's going out for war is what he's doing. But he's doing all of this under the pretense of piety, of worship, it even says in verse 8. It said, if the Lord wills indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will offer worship to the Lord. And so this vow he made, he tells his father, just outright lying to him, I believe, that if the Lord brings me back to Jerusalem, then I'm going to pay him homage. I'm going to go worship. He's setting up his deceit is what he's doing. He's doing it under the pretense of piety. And so then he's going to go out into this area with other people. He's going to drag other people along, which we'll come back to that, in this idea, this facade that he's going to worship and offer sacrifice so that then he can undermine his father's people. Everything about what Absalom is doing fits in perfectly with what is stated in Proverbs 6. He's just arrogant. He's haughty. He has a lying tongue. He's out to shed innocent blood. He's devising these wicked plans. He's running to evil. He's bearing false witness. He's breathing out lies. He's sowing discord among brethren. Right? He's not out there to help. He's out there to take over and do things for himself. And so we need to understand this at the beginning, this concept in Proverbs 6 about the way God feels about this sort of thing, that this is an abomination to him to speak these lies and to deceive and to manipulate the very thing that we see Absalom doing here in the story. But what I want us to see going forward is the vileness of deceit, the ugliness and the wickedness of what actually happens when there is deception and manipulation. In Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 18, it says, the one who conceals hatred has lying lips, and whoever utters slander is a fool. If you go back to the story of Absalom with Amnon, it's interesting because he is a manipulator and he is a deceiver. This is the very thing he does. He conceals his hatred. He acts so sweet and nice, right? He has this party with all the king's sons and he invites them all, and he even tries to invite David because he's just so good at what he does. And David says, we don't all need to go. And he says, well, let Amnon come. I mean, Absalom is good. He knows what he's doing. he is sweet and he is kind, and he's going to throw this party, this feast for everyone. Of course, it's all a ruse. It's all going to be because he's going to kill Amnon when the moment's right. But he conceals his hatred because he is a liar. And he's going to manipulate and he's going to deceive to get what he wants to get. That is the vileness. That is the ugliness of deceit. Rather than dealing with the issue, he conceals it. He evades it. He moves around it. He lies rather than dealing with the problem. He slanders. He destroys rather than confronting the issue. Rather than going to his father and saying, look, you didn't deal with Amnon. Look at the vileness of what Amnon did in raping my sister. You did not take care of that. And David did not take care of it. Did Absalom have a valid complaint? He certainly did. But then his methods and his ways are very underhanded in how he takes care of them. Rather than dealing with it outright, he takes justice into his own hands. Keep that in mind. He's offering justice to the men of Israel. Hey, you come to me and I will give you justice, while he works injustice in his life. This is how ugly manipulation and deceit really is. And I want us to see in Proverbs 11 what the wise man has to say about this. Just some select verses from Proverbs 11. It says, whoever belittles his neighbor lacks sense. Whoever goes about slandering reveals secrets. The wicked earns deceptive wages. That idea of that's what comes back to them. The one who is wicked and the one who slanders, the one who uses this, their mouth in such an evil way, they earn the wages of deception. Those of a crooked heart are an abomination to the Lord. So there's that word again, this abomination, the crooked heart and crooked speech. Be assured, an evil person will not go unpunished. Like a gold ring and a pig's snout is a beautiful woman without discretion. These things are not right. That's the illustration he's saying. And there's going to be destruction. There's going to be judgment on the one who tries to manipulate and deceive and twist and turn because it is vile and it is ugly and it does unmeasurable damage. This is what the wise man shares with us. Proverbs 25, the north wind brings forth rain and a backbiting tongue, angry looks. It is better to live in the corner of a housetop than a house shared with a quarrelsome wife. This is the ugliness of the sins of the mouth. They bring anger and destruction. They bring withdrawal. That's the second reference there. Living with the angry wife, the man withdraws to the corner of the house. And that is the nature of what happens with backbiting and deceit. It's the consequences of the ungodly use of the tongue. But ultimately what we need to see in this is that God will not allow this deceiver to work his deceits. Absalom was not going to succeed in what he was doing. And Psalm 101 has some things to say about this. God will not allow the deceiver to dwell in his house. Psalm 101 in verse 5, whoever slanders his neighbor secretly, I will destroy. Whoever has a haughty look and an arrogant heart, I will not endure. I will look with favor on the faithful in the land, that they may dwell with me. He who walks in the way that is blameless shall minister to me, serve to me. No one who practices deceit shall dwell in my house. No one who utters lies shall continue before my eyes. Morning by morning I will destroy all the wicked in the land, cutting off all the evildoers from the city of the Lord. The sad thing about the deceiver and the manipulator is they think they'll get away with it. They imagine that it's all going to work out and things are going to happen the way they want them to happen. But as the wise man says, and as the story says, and as the psalmist says, that is not going to be the case. There is going to be destruction. For the one who deceives, they're not going to get away with their deceit. Absalom was a user. He used everyone and everything that he could to try to get what he wanted. He used sacrifice as a means of treachery, as we already talked about. This appearance of worship and righteousness and piety, he uses that actually quite the opposite of Samuel and David, if you remember their stories, where they do something kind of similar, but it's for the will of God, it's for righteousness' sake. But he does just the opposite, where he deceives, acting as if he is religious and righteous. But it's the next part of the story that is really enlightening, I believe, with a manipulator like Absalom. If you look down in verse 11 of chapter 15 in 2 Samuel 15 and verse 11, as the story continues, it says, "With Absalom went 200 men from Jerusalem who were invited guests, and they went in their innocence and knew nothing." Just let that sink in for a moment. Absalom deceives the hearts of the men of Israel. And he does so to such a degree that he is able to get 200 men to run with him to the sacrifice who are innocent. They don't even understand what's happening. They know nothing. They don't understand the conspiracy. But yet there they are, these innocent people in the middle of this treachery of Absalom. And this is exactly what a manipulator and a deceiver does. He drags innocent people into his evil. Listening to the counsel of Ahithophel, he makes a power move by trying to show the people who's really in control. They throw a tent up on top of the building, the palace, and he sleeps there with David's concubines to show that he is ruler, that he is king. To strengthen his hand, Ahithophel says, "You don't mess with Absalom. He is the one who is truly in power now." This is the vileness, this is the ugliness of what deception and manipulation looks like. Going to such a degree that you work such immorality, such evil, to try to gain people to your side and try to strengthen your hand. Ahithophel is quite the counselor. David trusts his word before he betrays him. And now Absalom, at least at first, begins to trust Ahithophel and should have trusted Ahithophel if he was going to maintain his treachery. Actually, we learn the story. And by the working of God, the story makes out, going back to Psalm 101 and how the deceiver and the manipulator will not succeed. God works this plan to undo what Absalom is doing by the very fact that he doesn't continue to listen to Ahithophel. But I want us to see the mess that is created by Absalom in this situation. David has to run from the city, and all these people go with him, and he goes out weeping. And we're going to learn that there's actually a whole lot of people that follow David. As you continue on the story, half of the chapter 15 and going into 16 and 17, with a couple exceptions, is showing all the people who actually trust David rather than Absalom. They continue with him. He has quite the group of people who are on his side. And so I want us to see the arrogance and the stubbornness of the tongue trained in deceit next. We see the ugliness, we see the vileness of the one who's trying to sow discord. He's trying to destroy what is present there in Israel, because that's what happens with manipulation and deceit. But I want us to see the stubbornness. I want us to see the arrogance that's coming from Absalom, being unaware, ultimately, of the fact that this deceiver is being deceived. He is found out. He is being twisted, and he is being manipulated, though he thinks he is the manipulator and the deceiver. And yet he's worked himself into this place where judgment is going to be brought upon himself. Israel in general was like this in the time of Jeremiah. If you look at Jeremiah chapter 6, working really from the beginning of the book all the way to chapter 6 and then through chapter 9, what we see is that Israel is an unfaithful bride. That's the point being made in the first few chapters. They are not doing the will of God. They are doing things their own way. They are defying him at every turn. And he is pointing out all of their wickedness and their evil to them. And you come to chapter 6. In chapter 6, he makes this statement. "To whom shall I speak and give warning that they may hear? Behold, their ears are uncircumcised. They cannot listen." He said, "I'm trying to warn you. I'm trying to help you see the vileness of what you're doing. And yet you just won't listen." And then you turn to chapter 9 as he continues through their wickedness and their evil. He makes this statement. "They bend their tongue like a bow. Falsehood and not truth has grown strong in the land." This is verse 3. "And they proceed from evil to evil, and they do not know me, declares the Lord. Let everyone beware of his neighbor and put no trust in any brother, for every brother is a deceiver, and every neighbor goes about as a slanderer. Everyone deceives his neighbor, and no one speaks the truth. They have taught their tongue to speak lies. They weary themselves committing iniquity." The sad reality is the deceiver and the manipulator teaches their tongue to lie. It's an art, and they're very good at it. And they deceive many, just as Absalom deceived many. And they bring the innocent, and they bring those who don't know into their lies and into the manipulations, causing destruction in the wake of their path. But this is what God has to say. Their tongue is a deadly arrow. It speaks deceitfully. With his mouth, each speaks peace to his neighbor, but in his heart he plans an ambush for him. Shall I not punish them for these things, declares the Lord, and shall I not avenge myself on a nation such as this? The deceivers and the manipulators of Israel would not go unpunished. There is going to be judgment. This is serious. The way we use our mouth and the things that we do with our lips are important to the Lord because of the result, the consequences of what happens. The destruction that ensues and the discord that follows from the arrogant and from the stubborn manipulator who has trained their tongue in deceit. But here's the sad reality of even the ways of this manipulator and deceiver. He isn't nearly as smart as he thinks. And he imagines he'll get away with it and that no one will know and that they'll buy his story and that he'll drag them along in his usurping of his father's kingdom. But it turns out that David is a little wiser and more experienced than Absalom. He's pretty good at war. And he knows how these things work. In fact, I can't know for sure, but it wouldn't surprise me if David's initial actions are well conceived. When he leaves the city and he brings people with him, we know that David knows how to flee, and he knows how to hide. He did that for a long time. And whatever Absalom has planned, David is a step ahead. He knows much more than Absalom in the art of war and how this is all going to work. And you notice on his path out of town, if you read this text fully, all along the way, he's setting things up to his advantage. He's sending back Zadok the priest and Jonathan Abiathar's son. Hushai meets him, and all these people are meeting him. They want to come with him. All these people that Absalom isn't aware of. And he tells Hushai, you go back to the city, and you work on my end. And you reveal, again, this is where the deceiver is deceived and manipulated. Absalom's trade may have fooled the common man in Israel, but it certainly did not fool those of significance and power. Those who trusted David far more than Absalom were not deceived by Absalom. They knew what he was up to. And the scary thing about all of this is we consider the dangers of deceit and manipulation. If I imagine myself as someone who can get the things I want, I need to understand something. Manipulators are not nearly as good as they imagine. They certainly don't fool God. And manipulators eventually mess up. They take things too far, like Absalom did. David. They say or do the wrong thing to the wrong person. And their treachery is exposed, and things go very poorly for them. Ahithophel hangs himself. I believe he knows what's up with all of this. His counsel is not taken. And Hushai, who is the deceiver and the manipulator against Absalom, his counsel is taken. Absalom and his foolishness doesn't see the reality of what Hushai actually says, another irony in the story. He convinces Absalom to wait. Ahithophel wants him to go that night and try to kill just David. And he had good counsel if that was going to work. The text tells us so. Hushai, in his deceit on David's end, convinces Absalom to wait and to gather all Israel. He plays to Absalom's ego, that Absalom thinks he's going to make this work. And ironically, he points out, don't you realize that your father is an expert at war? And notice this line. His men are enraged. like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. And yet Absalom falls right into the trap. He messes up. And the manipulator better hope that when they mess up for those who deal gently. David pleads with his men. In chapter 18, he says, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom." And all the people heard what the king said. Unfortunately for Absalom, he was discovered by Joab. And Joab wasn't too interested in dealing gently. In fact, he picked up 3 javelins and stabbed them through his heart. And then 10 of his men, his armor bearers, beat him to death. And so the manipulator better hope they find those who are gentle when they're found out. We need to see the collateral damage that takes place in this story of Absalom. The destruction that takes place is his father has to flee the castle. And the people are deceived and their hearts are turned away from David falsely. And all the problems and the anxiety and the trouble that is caused because of Absalom's manipulation and deceit that ultimately results in his own death. And in doing so, the grief is of his own father. His father grieves over Absalom, the deceiver, the manipulator, the one who is trying to take his kingdom while his own people have succeeded in war, and Joab tries to correct him. There's problems being caused by Absalom even after his death because of what he did to his father. And so I want to bring us back to this passage in James 1. If anyone thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue but deceives his heart, this person's religion is worthless. 7 things are an abomination to God. And 5 of those involve the way we use our mouth. Manipulating and deceiving are the top of the list of the things he hates. And so we talk about this sort of thing sometimes, about being careful what we say, how we use our words. But my goal this morning is to help us really understand the gravity of how important it is that we carefully consider the things that we say. Because if we don't, great evil and great destruction can take place among God's people. That very last thing in that list in Proverbs 6, that the Lord hates, that is an abomination, is sowing discord. In Revelation 21, you're familiar with the verse. He tells us that all liars go to the lake of fire. It's serious. And God wants us to know that. I want us to leave understanding, though, that there's hope. If we've gone down this path, if we have deceived, if we have manipulated, if we have lied, which many of us have done in our lives at some point, He gives us an advocate. We have Jesus Christ as an advocate to the Father. He loves us so much. It is the exact opposite of the sort of thing you see in Absalom. But the Father, He loves us so much that He gave His Son to die for our sins at the right time, Romans 5 tells us. Even while we are sinners, Christ died for the ungodly. He died, listen carefully, He died for the manipulator and for the deceiver, the very person we just talked about, Absalom and people like him. He died for those. So maybe you find yourself in that scenario this morning. It is evil, it is wicked, it is horrible, and it is destructive. But the reality is, there's hope. You can make those things known. You can fix it. Stop telling the lies. Stop twisting the stories. Stop manipulating. That's not the way to fix it. Stop the stubbornness. Stop the arrogance. It's not going to work. It's what we just looked at. But in humility, we can fall before God and say, forgive me. You will do it. That's the love and grace of the God that we serve. He cares that much about us. Despite all the destruction that can be caused, even death, in the case of Absalom, of various people who are part of this conspiracy, even in all of it, Absalom could have turned. He could have made it right. And we can do the same thing this morning. If we find ourselves there, we can turn and make it right. Maybe you're living that life and you're not even in Christ yet. Maybe you don't understand what that even means, and we'd be glad to talk to you more about that. But there is hope. This is not the only path. It's a path that leads to destructive end, but there is a path that leads to eternal life. And that is through Jesus Christ. You can give your life to Christ this morning. You can be baptized. You go into the water, a person of sin and defilement, and those sins are washed away in the waters of baptism. You come up out of the water in newness of life. You can begin new. That's the sort of